and they can't be used. And so we're very concerned about the safety of those beagles, and that's why we went in to try to get those beagles to safety.
We just have 20 seconds, Rebecca. Explain what debarking is.
So the way it was conducted at Ridgeland Farms, the workers would go to the kennel and they would essentially hold the dog while another worker would reach down the dog's throat with like scissors or forceps. And then they would rip out the dog's vocal cords and throw them on the ground in these barns. This is what former employees have told us was happening there. It's a really horrific practice because the dogs are barking in distress. These are dogs living on wire flooring for their whole lives, never getting outside, never seeing sunlight. And then so when they're distressed and they are barking like that, the workers don't like it. So they devocalize them, according to the employees.
Rebecca Robinson, I want to thank you for being with us, member of the Coalition to Save the Ridgeland Dogs, arrested at the action this weekend in Wisconsin. That does it for our show. Tonight I'll be at the Tower Theater in Sacramento for a Q&A after the screening of Steal This Story, Please. Tomorrow, Thursday, I'll be introducing the film at the Roxy in San Francisco and the Rialto Elmwood in Berkeley. Then at the Seattle International Film Festival, Uptown Cinema in Seattle. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're listening to X-Ray FM, KXRY Portland at 91.1 FM, K296 FT West Haven serving Portland at 107.1 FM, and K219 KU Nehalem serving the Oregon coast at 91.7 FM, streaming live and archived at xray.fm. Radio is yours!
Today on Wings, we return to the World Women's Congress for a Healthy Planet, Miami, 1991, for the conclusion of Wings' documentary, Agenda to Save the Planet. Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
It almost gets to be tiresome to have to continue and repeat as we do that women must be part of decision making. But if we keep saying it long enough and act upon it as we're trying to do here, it will come about.
Former U.S. Congresswoman Bella Abzug convened 1,500 women from 83 countries to prepare a consensus document about what women want to see on the agenda of the June 1992 United Nations Conference on Environment and Development. A resolution calling for equal participation by women was the first item agreed upon by the participating nations. Now the issue is whether this was only lip service.
We're not going to ask for much. But for starters, a lot of talk has been made here about women's participation in decisions. So we suggest no more than 60% or less than 40% of either sex should be included in leadership posts in the United Nations, its specialized agencies and programs, in governments and public policy making groups in every region in the world, and especially in the member delegations that go to Rio in June. We're not going to ask for much. We only think we should get about half of international development funds and resources allocated to women's programs and projects in developing countries in compensation for 46 years of underfunding the needs of women and children, the poorest of the poor. We're not going to ask for much. We're going to ask for a very important thing, and that is that unless and until men and women together share in the responsibilities, share in the obligations, and share in the rights and the production and distribution in this world will not be able to continue.
Rosalie Bertel, a Canadian epidemiologist, was one of 15 experts who formally testified at the World Women's Congress for a Healthy Planet. She was one of many whose testimony helped shape the Women, Militarism, and the Environment section of the 71-point Women's Action Agenda.
It's our earth. It's all we have. It's our air. It's our water. It's our food. It's babies. It's the future. And it has been seriously damaged and seriously jeopardized, which is why we are here. And I like the analogy of the bathtub, and I would like to put the plug in, because we can't keep running the water and having it run out. And I think the plug is the military, that we have to deal with that.
We demand nuclear weapons be dismantled and destroyed, that nuclear testing cease immediately. We've got lots more in this lot. We demand that space activities and supersonic flight, which threatens the ozone layer or releases carbon dioxide, cease. We urge an immediate 50% reduction in military spending. We demand creation of national civilian commissions with 50% membership of women, which would open to public scrutiny all military activities, expenditures, and research and development. We demand that national armies be converted into environmental protection corps, which would monitor and repair damage to natural systems, including cleanup of military bases, and be available to assist citizens in times of natural and man-made disasters. We condemn governments that turn their armies against their citizens, leading millions of individuals to become refugees and displaced persons. And we will educate our daughters and sons to shun military service if it is in the service of governments which use military power to exploit the resources and people of other nations.
All the wars of the military-industrial complex, the bombs dropped there, now we're dying of cancer, the chickens are coming home to roost in our own environment.
While the wars have been fought, and we are supposedly at peace, the casualties of war are here. We are the casualties of war, especially the ones that live around the military facilities. And we're not recognized as such. But we are the ones that they experiment on first for the nuclear weapons and for all the weapons that they're making. And we are the ones that are, there's women that are bathing their babies in Rocky Mountain flats that have nerve gas products in their water.
The way we unmask the wolf in sheep's clothing is to find if they bring us poison, to find if they bring us sickness, to find if they bring us death. And we must uncover it. And we must demand accountability and destruction and elimination of this whole secret military system, which destroys our earth and its livability. I think women are going to have to take the initiative, and women's groups are going to have to take the initiative to look at their own nation and to begin to issue report cards, to begin to say, are we going in the right direction or are we deteriorating? And if we are deteriorating, why? So one of the things that we're calling for political action is to begin to critically rate our own nations in terms of five things. One is the health of the natural environment. The second thing we'd like to look at is the health of the value system, which is motivating and driving our nation. The third thing is the health of the political system and the participatory nature of our nations. What kind of marks would they get? The fourth is the health of resource distribution and the households of our nation. And the last and fifth is the health of our human development systems. And I think the things we care about fall into all five categories. And I must thank Eva Nordlund from Norway for pulling together the report card system and giving it life and bringing it to this conference.
We hope that someday, pretty soon, we will not only have a UN Security Council for military questions, but a UN Health Security Council. And we women can bring from all the countries in the world our report cards, what the progress is in our countries relating to the political system, the value system, the natural system, and our children and our old people. So this is the idea. Thank you very much.
Just a short question on the report cards about which you talked just now. Some of them seem to require a little more specialized knowledge to answer. So what sort of groups do you have in mind for filling in these report cards?
The report cards have two parts. One is a general overall estimate of your nation. You know, do we have problems in the area of our value system or our politics? And is anything being done about it? Has there been any progress? Are there efforts? Do we rate fairly well in this, and are we improving, and are we sharing? There is a second section which is more quantified, which has to do with how much literacy in our country, what is the equity between genders in our country, how many people have shelter, how many people are malnourished, and so on. So there are some attempts also to quantify the health of our nation and to put these together to find the health of our region, the health of our world, because it's only if we make progress on every one of these fronts that we will have a healthy planet.
We have to clear up the mess, so to speak, and therefore we have a right to question the people who created the mess. Should we also not insist that those who created the mess themselves clean it up also?
One of the five judges of the tribunal, Justice Sujata Manohar from the Bombay High Court, questions witness Peggy Antrobus, a development specialist from Barbados.
You asked, shouldn't the people who create the mess clean it up themselves? Yes, I mean, that is one of the things that... But if you ask the industrialists who are creating the mess to clean it up, it costs them more money, it'll affect their profits, and that is where the resistance comes from, because they're not prepared to do that.
We call for the creation of a permanent UN Environmental Commission to serve as an ombudsperson, receive individual complaints, monitor compliance, and enforce principles of an international code of environmental ethics. We require all states and corporations who produce toxic chemical agents to dispose of their toxic waste within their own borders.
On Wings, you're listening to voices and ideas from the World Women's Congress for a Healthy Planet.
Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, another witness, is a former finance minister of Liberia and worked on trade issues for the World Bank.
Disproportionate distribution of and access to world resources has served to keep a few countries rich, very rich, and the majority of countries poor, very poor.
Jacqueline Pitangui, former president of the National Council of the Rights of Woman, Brazil.
I just wanted to bring another perspective to the discussion. It's not exactly a question, but I think that we have to think of logics and what kind of logics are going on maximization of profit and maximization of chances of survival. We cannot talk of environment without considering that the poor people, and the poor people, which is the majority of the population in our countries, they are maximizing their chances of survival because there is a maximization of profit going on the economic values and on the market values. But the logic is the same. It's at the expenses of the nature. And it's to guarantee their survival today that they have to cut the trees, they have to put earth on an ecosystem and build a house there, or the floods will come and will destroy because there was deforestation. And I think that the North has pointed a finger to us too much, as though the poverty was not considered. So I think that North and South are linked by this logic of maximization of profit, which is perverse. It is a perverse trend because there is maximization of profit at the expenses of nature, which leads to the need to maximize the chances of survival also at the expenses of nature. And I think those two questions have to be considered when we talk about the value of ecosystems and find the measures to deal with it.
We call for the renegotiation of terms of trade that will ensure an equitable relationship between the price of raw materials and prices of manufactured goods.
A creative approach to trade imbalance and third world debt came out of discussion in a workshop.
I'd like to suggest, as a member of the third world, that one of the things for us that would equate the present debt we carry is if you did an environmental audit historically. We do an audit of the ecosystems as they existed in 1940s after the war. We see where they are, we see who the user was, and we see who the net beneficiary was. And if we can get a net beneficiary assessment, then for Guyana, we will know that Canada made money off of our bauxite, Britain made money out of our lumber, so-and-so made money out of thing, and maybe we can cancel our debt just based on that.
We suggest that historic audits of nation states from 1945 onward be conducted to determine the net beneficiaries of natural resource exploitation, an assessment which would serve as the basis of to cancel current debt.
Foreign debt is a matter of crucial importance to women in developing countries because it is being used by the World Bank and International Monetary Fund to force cuts in public services. Every lost daycare center or public bus or hospital bed or food subsidy or public sector job forces more unwaged work on women, whose contribution to sustaining life isn't counted in the gross domestic product.
We call for the rejection of structural adjustments policies, SAPs, which shift the responsibilities of basic social services from governments to women without compensation or assistance.
Nancy Barry is on leave from the World Bank to serve as president of Women's World Banking, which helps poor women start their own lending institutions.
What structural adjustment lending is balance of payment support, essentially in exchange for governments changing their macroeconomic policies and opening up their economies and reforming their financial systems and privatizing their public enterprises. The World Bank talks a lot about the supply response. Basically, the supply response means that economies grow, that exports improve, that poor people increase their income. And in order for that to happen, you cannot expect that you change the exchange rate, liberalize imports, and the rest will take care of itself. I mean, that is an absurd proposition. One of the things that the World Bank really needs to worry about now is getting more people at the technical level and at the managerial level who are not macroeconomists. One of the problems in going through 10 years of the macroeconomist as king is that even when the World Bank figures out, as it has internally, that structural adjustment has not worked terribly well and certainly not the way it was done, those are the people that are still running the show.
The ludicrous inadequacy of current economic theory was the text of testimony by Marilyn Waring, a well-known feminist economist and former member of New Zealand's parliament.
First of all, the boys are calling a whole new field of study ecological economics. It's a bit of a problem with eco, of course, the Greek derivation from home, and the way the boys treat ecological economics, it doesn't have a great deal to do with home. It uses, it would be suggested, conventional economic tools, despite all the caveats which the boys enter about how these are not really appropriate and it's very difficult to cram them all into one system, etc. For those of you who aren't up with the play, growth is anything that passes through the market for which cash is exchanged. There isn't a debit side of growth, so it's not like running the housekeeping, and there isn't a legal or illegal demarcation either, so that it's really good for growth to smoke lots of cigarettes, have lots of car accidents, wars are sensational, the few eggs on Valdez's into icebergs are extremely good. I don't know why people worry about Noriega. I mean, illegal drugs are what a lot of the South even produces to even get any form of growth rate.
Waring's testimony brought about resolutions calling for differentiation between constructive and destructive production, and another opposing environmental accounting. Marilyn Waring.
We must fight very hard what is happening. The United Nations Statistical Office has already approved the establishment of environmental accounts inside the system of national accounts. They will involve the commodification of everything that can be perceived as having a market value. But these things are nightmares because, of course, national income accounting works inside nation states. And one of the things that nature can teach us, thankfully, is that it doesn't know anything about nation state boundaries. Is acid rain going to be recorded as a natural export to Canada? And quite where is Canada going to record this now in its income accounts? And the same for Norway. Is it going to think that it just got some aid from the UK when the next lot of acid rain hits? Or, you know, where is it quite supposed to pop it? And in the Pacific, when the French exploded another bomb in Mururoa, and we would just like to send it home to Paris, but it doesn't work like that. When we get our dead fish and our jelly babies and our leukemia, just quite where are we supposed to record this in our national income accounts? So I have some trouble with the fact that we even think that we can number crunch it inside a nation state context. But the inability to attribute a market value to part of the ecosystem doesn't mean that it's not worthy of consideration. But the treatment of the environment in national accounts and in public policy reproduces the arrogant ideology that only money is of value and only the market is a source of knowledge.
The Secretary General of the United Nations Conference on Environment and Development attended the final plenary of the Congress. He heard the statement by the five judges who weighed the formal testimony.
Secretary General Morris Strong and honored guests, I want to introduce them to you individually. The Honorable Justice Elizabeth Evatt from Australia, the Justice Desiree Bernard of Guyana, Justice Siyata V. Manohar from India, Lady Justice F.E.U.R. from Kenya, and Judge Margareta Wattstein of Sweden. I now call upon the Honorable Justice Elizabeth Evatt of Australia to render the decision of the tribunal.
If I could turn now to what we've called the declaration of the tribunal of the Miami World Women's Congress for a Healthy Planet. We believe that to tackle the problems that have been identified by the many speakers here at this Congress, the actions of state governments, international agencies, private organizations, and individuals should be guided by three basic principles. They are, first, global equity; second, resource ethics; and third, empowerment of women. As to global equity, the global environment is the necessary condition of life. As such, it cannot be the exclusive preserve of any individual. The principle of equity should guide states individually and collectively in determining who has access to and use of basic resources. The first priority should be given to meeting the basic human rights and needs of all people, especially the right of everyone to an adequate standard of living, including adequate food, clothing, and housing, and to the continuous improvement of living conditions. I quote there from the Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. Those principles should guide financial and economic policies. The second principle, resource ethics. The use of natural resources should be guided by ethical principles which balance the need for material progress with the sustainability of resources and which base living standards on long-term sustainability and on responsibility towards future generations. The third principle is the empowerment of women. The women's perspective, which recognizes that meeting human and social needs is a goal of higher importance than economic progress for its own sake, must be brought to bear on global problems of environmental destruction and poverty arising from inequitable access to necessary survival resources. Women must be empowered at all levels to contribute to the achievement of the principles of equity, social justice, and ethics.
In responding to the women's agenda, Secretary General Strong pointed out it would be difficult to get substantive results from the Earth Summit in Brazil. Magda Renner, spokesperson on environment for Brazil's National Confederation of Women, offers advice for the event.
I have been for 2 years at the NGO World Bank Committee and always behaving very well and writing hundreds of papers and making thousands of suggestions, which then always were considered very enlightening, but nothing happened. But when we went into the streets with our big banners, standing in New York where it was forbidden to stay, and the police came, then it was an affair, and then suddenly all those men started listening to what we were saying. So we must be visible when all the dignitaries, the powerful men are coming to Brazil in Rio de Janeiro. We must be there, we must be standing in the streets. We must be crying out at them. We don't not behaving so well as we always do, just standing there. Yeah, it's true. Just standing, just hearing, and not having the possibility to speak. So if we don't have the possibility to speak during the official meetings, let us stand in the streets where those men have to pass to go into their beautiful cars. And let us make our demonstrations there.
Give us back our rainforest in the heart of the Amazon. Give us back our oceans pure.
This concludes the two-part documentary, Agenda to Save the Planet, produced by Frieda Worden and funded by Genevieve Vaughn, author of the book Forgiving, A Feminist Criticism of Exchange. For more about WINGS, check our website, www.wings.org, or email wings@wings.org. The Old Wings sound logo you heard in this show was created by Maggie Payne. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Support for X-Ray FM comes from Spielman Bagels and Coffee. Opened by Rick Spielman and his son, Raf, Spielman's has been serving handmade boiled and baked bagels and house-roasted coffee since 2011 in their flagship store located on Southeast 20th and Division Street. More information and hours at SpielmanBagels.com.
Support for X-Ray comes from New Deal Distillery. Find small-batch craft spirits, bottled cocktails, local mixers, beer, wine, and more at New Deal Distillery and Bottle Shop, located in the Central East Side at 900 Southeast Salmon Street. More information at newdealdistillery.com.
God, I wanna go home, stay out there. It's a hell of a thing. Dream us up in desire.
So I wait by the phone, ringing out in the hall.
I'm not rotted in chalk on a skeleton wall.
Is this all there is?
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 freckles in our eyes are mirror images, and when we kiss they're perfectly aligned. And I have to speculate that God himself did make us into corresponding shapes like thoughts like this that catch my trouble head when you're away, when I am missing you to death. When you are out there on the road for several weeks of shows, and when you scan the
is Angle of View. Today is April 21st, 2026. I'm Will Hatman. So look, I'm really, really busy with some things I can't tell you about yet, which is why I've been gone the last 2 weeks, and also why I can only get through today's episode and the next few by deploying a contingency plan that I devised in secret when the show first started. Coverage of new releases is hereby suspended until further notice. Broadcasts will consist instead of reviews of older movies, where older is defined in terms of the show's history, to mean before 2024. For fun, I will indicate the date that I wrote the review, as well as, to the best of my recollection, which viewing the review accompanied. There is, of course, a chance of me being in the right place at the right time to catch a new release or two at choice points over the next few months. If that happens, and if I can also cheat my way into some real writing time, I will be more than happy to share my thoughts with you. But for the most part, the show is going to have to pull out of the vein of the contemporary for a little while. Who knows, maybe it'll be good for me, akin to one of those overdue sober stretches. Contemporary movies are a lot like drugs, actually. They cost too much, they give you terrible hangovers. The only thing that's missing from the analogy is that before the hangover sets in, most drugs actually make you feel good. Anyway, how will I choose which reviews to pull out of the drawer and blow the dust off? Well, surely you would agree that one of the most valuable things a critic can do is champion something underseen and stimulate new interest in it. And so that is exactly what I am going to do later, perhaps. In these early episodes, out of a desire to keep you listening, I'm going to do the perfect opposite of that and talk about Barbie and Oppenheimer. Barbie, 2023, directed by Greta Gerwig. Review date, July 25th, 2023. First and only viewing. The most charitable reading of Barbie is that a major woman artist looked back on her youth spent playing with Barbie dolls and was able to express her complicated feelings about Barbie as a totem of womanhood in a way that, quite by chance and happily, was conducive to Mattel's marketing and advertising strategy. The least charitable reading of Barbie is that amid the extremely disheartening rising tide of movies about products, Mattel, in nabbing a talent like Greta Gerwig and in personifying the product rather than just venerating its inventor, simply made the smartest and most interesting movie about a product so far. Here's the thing, though. The gravity of the cultural event that is Barbie is so strong, and its surface so slippery, that you have only to stare at either of those two readings for a few seconds before it morphs into the other. It's all one perfectly inscrutable, ungraspable, diamond-hard object, impervious to interpretation. American culture's biggest and most official encounter yet with the phenomenon of the product that comes bundled with a critique of itself. With every critique of itself, actually. Anything you could think to say about it, it says first, displaying an almost childish determination to win every such race, and nya-nya about it. Every possible audience response is anticipated and articulated and reabsorbed back into the product faster than you could form it in your own head. By this hyperactive cleverness, you aren't permitted a personal experience of the movie. As with any strong ad, exhaustive pains are taken to ensure that nobody will experience it differently from anybody else. The only critical thoughts which would resist this power are the ones that you knew in advance would never be granted oxygen in a Mattel production, e.g. about plastic waste, labor conditions, and the other material ways in which this product leaves everlasting impressions upon the earth. Because the movie has become such a big deal, treating it like a regular movie feels totally inadequate. It's a phenomenon, above all else, a post-postmodern actual celebration of capitalism, which has given us, as a grotesque bonus, the sideshow of pointy-headed dorks like me dusting off their theory books to decode a movie about the Barbie doll in the middle of a summer in which every new day is the new hottest day in the history of the planet. Welcome to the exact future that the 20th century Marxists warned us about. Anyway, we've got a fascinating artifact on our hands, but it's not really anything to be happy about. Oppenheimer, 2023, directed by Christopher Nolan. Review date, July 23rd, 2023. First and only viewing. Everything Christopher Nolan touches takes on instantaneous heavy importance. So I, for one, am glad that he started reaching out to subject matter that matches this vibration. This is almost certainly one of the reasons that Oppenheimer is the best movie he's ever made. His pre-existing and inflexible tendencies toward the somber finally have real soil to till. The undergirding of both the story and the telling are actually so strong that this movie proves which of Nolan's problems are the truly untamable ones. They're the only ones that still show through the fabric. His ideas about what makes good editing are blinkered. That's perhaps the one aspect of his filmmaking that didn't grow up here. This movie is cut to the same fast but rather ponderous rhythm that he taught himself through his action movies, and it works against not just the total pacing of the material, but the basic strength of the shots. We never, ever linger on anything, even though we have production values that deserve to be shown off, and material that is meant to arouse not just contemplation but torment. The shot selection, per se, is not bad. You can quibble with Nolan's seeming preference for tight shots on the grounds that it seems an odd use of 70mm, but a lot of the real story takes place in small rooms, so it fits. More importantly, when you're meant to see a magnificent southwestern panorama, you will see one. He knows that the montage has to include establishing shots, and the problem isn't how he frames those shots, it's the fact that he cuts away from each of them within a second and a half. The camera always urgently needs to be somewhere else, always chasing action in medium and close shots, even though the action is mostly dialogue, and this dialogue is generally so solemn that it's jarring to be hurried through it. Some of this falls to the way Nolan directs the actor's delivery, but it's mostly an editing problem. It's just not an adequately patient film. Imagine a James Bond movie in terms of tempo and pulse, something with that kind of machine gun crispness, but it's a 3-hour political drama. And imagine that its scenes are packed with so much talk, most of it expository, that the frenzied pace makes it seem more like 4 hours of movie squished into a 3-hour container. But now, for extra fun, imagine that it's actually compelling, in spite of all this. Imagine that it does, successfully, organically, interrogate the scientist's definition of progress and accompanying motor drive, and shows you that moral blindness that takes hold in the throes of discovery, and the terror of the reckoning that crashes down later, weighing all the more for the delay. Imagine that it's as fair and penetrating a reckoning with this phenomenon, and with the spirit of a man broken by it, as a Christopher Nolan script could ever have been hoped to provide. It actually connects on these intended levels, and it's in large part because, amazingly, the dialogue, Nolan's own, is almost always strong, even as his direction undermines it somewhat. It has to wrestle with a different problem in its last hour. The engine stalls out as the investigations take over the story, and the rooms become so oppressive that it threatens briefly to make the movie boring. But it is saved from that fate by the dialogue managing to keep its edge. And it's got another wonderful quality to thank for its success. Cillian Murphy, the beautiful rodent with the brilliant blue eyes devastated by incurable sadness. The conscience of Murphy's Oppenheimer is eternally ruined, and it shows in his face in a form of pure anguish that becomes poignant on sight by the end. It's a performance crushed to a small pipsqueak size along with the character, and it only gets stronger as it gets smaller. And although all the real action is compressed into one sequence, the Los Alamos detonation, the sequence is magnificently daring, the sound mix of the explosion putting the character's anxious panting in every nook and cranny of the mix so that the experience becomes terrible and sexual. The widely lauded auditorium sequence is also very stirring, and it's rather amazing that its risks are rewarded. The high feelings that these sequences get at and achieve represent exactly the kind of thing I feel like I never could have expected from Christopher Nolan before. These are also the two sequences in which that otherwise inappropriate editing approach works unequivocally in his favor. It's in these sequences when you feel most strongly that he not only finally chose the right kind of story for his disposition, but he actually expanded his disposition in service of the story, finding his way to a new kind of manic fervor. Oliver Stone, that's who this feels like. The same brand of especially righteous paranoia, of a history lesson all jacked up on fear and anger. It's not quite as deep as it thinks it is, which is a problem Stone also used to have, and it's far too impressed with its own casting. Every new performer's reveal is treated with a bigger workup than the previous one, and in how most of these great character actors are used, the reveal seems to have been 9/10 of the point. They're like SNL walk-ons. As a matter of fact, this is also a problem that Oliver Stone used to have. Strong exception here, though, for David Krumholtz, who has gained extraordinary presence in middle age, possibly on his way to becoming the next Michael Lerner. I could keep picking nits, but what matters most is, this is the first time Christopher Nolan has ever dared move beyond a pure machinist's technique and tried to put some blood in. It's a welcome change. The King of Comedy, 1982, directed by Martin Scorsese. Review date October 4th, 2023. Probably third viewing. Transcendent discomfort. Discomfort sublimated into something purifying, as if for an ascetic. There has never been another movie protagonist like Rupert Pupkin. He seems more like a character from 1960s American fiction, Barthelme maybe, or Coover, in how completely unaware he is of how society works and the composure with which he goes about his backward business. Watching someone with that combination of confidence and cluelessness move through the world in any capacity makes you twist up your face cringing. The Office, in both versions, had multiple characters like this. But watching that person in pursuit of a show business career, deciding that his very first step should be to gatecrash his universe's equivalent of The Tonight Show, is so harrowing a level of cringe that you somehow emerge feeling cleaner about humanity. Our ranks may be full of lunatics and creeps, but no real person has ever acted like that. But just because nobody ever has, does that mean nobody ever could? After all, Rupert is ultimately reducible to a stalker, and stalkers are very real and almost always have weird ideas about what they deserve. Rupert is motivated not by a purely egotistical fantasy of becoming a famous comedian, but by a fantasy of entwinement with Jerry Langford, of being his heir in comedy and receiving the torch from him in an extremely public way. Most stalkers have elaborate visions in their heads about the nuts and bolts of their eventual togetherness with the object of their obsession, exactly what they'll do together after they have been united and where, what they'll be wearing, every line of the script for their conversations. To the most minute detail, they know what they want their victim for. The character of Masha, though likely thought up initially for plot reasons, insofar as an abduction requires more abductors than abductees, ends up being most powerful as a foil for Rupert in this regard, the stalker whose desire for the stalked is more traditional. She wants Jerry for sex and wild nights out, which is her idea of love. You see her and think, that's a stalker. And then you look back at Rupert and think, but what's going on with this guy? But Rupert's operating on his own idea of love. To him, being recognized as a great stand-up in the mold of Jerry Langford is achieving intimacy with him. It's the culmination of a lifelong tribute. I could see somebody having an idea that weird. Robert De Niro has a way of holding his face in this little pursed smile that's unique to this performance. De Niro's real smile is broad and beautiful and brings a shine to his eyes, but Rupert's smile, especially under that mustache, is completely different, almost officious, like a magazine ad model. It's a device that gets more impressive the more you stare at it because it represents how much faith Rupert has in himself. Despite seeming to be completely incapable of engaging in real communication with another human being, he enters every encounter led by that proud and pleased smile, always looking already victorious. By the end, as he gets improbably closer to achieving his goal, it's funny just on sight. De Niro is, in truth, the funniest he's ever been in a movie here, finding the most beautiful little glinting comic touches in his delivery of his most absurd lines, while still able to turn up the temperature of Rupert's encounters with Jerry, using a quality that approaches real scariness. In his single most glorious moment, he is forcing Jerry at gunpoint to call his producer and put him on the show. After the producer's secretary mistakes Jerry for a crank-calling impressionist and hangs up on him, Rupert, having previously been thrown out of the building twice, says, "I'll let you in on a little secret. That's the same way they treated me. And now look where we are." The movie's most glorious moment, though, belongs to Sandra Bernhard as Masha, finding herself so ecstatic at having Jerry as her captive at last, taped to a chair across her dining room table, that her ideas about how to express her glee come too fast and with too much firepower for her to handle. Scorsese expands into a new technical power yet again here. The static approach to interiors that didn't work in Raging Bull, because there weren't any ingredients in the pot, here becomes a magnificent source of escalating awkward tension. Everyone who spends time with Rupert is in essence trapped with him, and this only comes to feel more nightmarish under Fred Schuller's frigid lights. Eraserhead, 1978, directed by David Lynch. Review date, July 5th, 2025. Probably sixth viewing. Eraserhead, David Lynch's singularly mesmerizing debut feature, is his most fully realized movie. I can never decide whether I think it's his best altogether, but it's the one in which the elements are most effectively and organically united. At a glance, this risks appearing like a facile comment to make about a movie that took 5 years to complete. One had damn well better be committed to a movie to spend that much time on it, and this goes not just for Lynch, but for everyone else involved. Imagine being Jack Nance and having to maintain that haircut. But 5 years is also more than enough time for a vision to fall apart, or slip out of the artist's grasp. That production time could have become a great big stage for doubts about the project to play out on, or accumulating frustration at the prolongation itself could have driven cast or crew to get impatient and break off to join simpler films. Or just as easily, the thing could have simply dissolved. One day everybody could have shown up on set having forgotten what they were doing when they started out. It's a profound testament to David Lynch's command as a director that Eraserhead not only escaped those ill fates, but is so magnificent a fusion of forms and ideas that it makes that notorious gestation period seem almost as though it had been necessary, like the film was a ceramic piece that required an especially long firing in the kiln, or else it might not have held its shape. Naturally, it was because of practical constraints, severe limits on budget, space access, and cast and crew schedule management that it took so long to make. But to watch it, you wonder whether the aesthetic world of the film would have ended up this beautifully articulated without the gift of that time. Whether a story this far out of the orbit of ordinary movies could have been given the same stunning confidence of presentation had the cast and crew not effectively lived inside that world for as long as they were forced to. Ultimately, the movie is not a mere showcase of that world as a made object. It is an organic experience of it, and from within, the experience of someone born there. How cheap words seem when applied to something like this. It doesn't penetrate the skin of Eraserhead by a centimeter to call it weird or gross, though you could hardly be blamed if those words took up your forebrain on first viewing. Nor would you get there by tacking on more adjectives, scary or angsty. Its theme is domesticity, and parenting specifically, as life-ruining nightmare. And its visual language is one of the most earnestly upsetting hells ever dreamed up in a movie, a nauseous mix of organic and industrial abominations which find their nexus in the choice to render all the houseplants and trees as dead sticks stuck in dirt piles. But as that image partly indicates, it's also really, really funny. The exigency to which Henry, Nance, has had to sacrifice his life, the insatiable, unutterable needs of his monstrous infant, without exaggeration the greatest creature in the history of special effects, is a suffocating horror. But the life he's left behind for the baby's sake doesn't much seem worth missing. Henry's dinner with his girlfriend and her parents is a hilariously bad time, even before he learns about the baby. Nor does the fantasy life he imagines in the radiator seem beautiful except by comparison and within the same ghastly aesthetic confines. Real beauty is foreclosed, just as real comfort and safety are. The way the film symbolizes the baby's conception is grimly mechanical. Levers are pulled and giant spermatozoa fall from Henry's mouth through space and into a milky lake, like an art installation. But the way it symbolizes copulation bends this same vocabulary to tender erotic ends. When Henry has a dalliance with the beautiful woman across the hall, another milky lake materializes in his bedroom, and they slip down into it together, leaving just her hair floating on the surface. The film is visually so fertile and spectacular that it seems a contradiction for it to be able to hold such a wealth of images within such strict limitations of scope and setting. Those limitations, along with the binding cloth of the incredible haunting sound design and omnipresent noise floor, which is the oral complement to the visual aesthetic, the gray howl of a machine having a bad dream, give it an inspired focus and wholeness. We'll be back next week with reviews of some more classics. I don't know which yet. My theme music is by me and Johann Wagner. My logo design is by Aaron Robert Miller. Find these and more than 1,000 of my other reviews and write